We've come a long way from the days of buying almost nothing but canned or frozen food from the mega supermarket. Recent years have seen a flowering of interest in good, wholesome foods grown closer to home in sustainable and ecologically sound ways. Today's guest got way ahead of that movement. Dr. Vandana Shiva is a little hard to categorize, but activist is for sure part of her description. Vandana Shiva speaks in Ashland tomorrow night in a session called Seed Sovereignty, Food Security, and Climate Resilience. That has been sold out, but there's also a bump-out room where people can watch on closed-circuit TV at the Rogue River Room at Southern Oregon University tomorrow night at 7. Dr. Vandana Shiva has been active on food security issues for decades now, with emphases on sustainability, organic farming, and resistance to corporate agriculture and intellectual property rights on food sources. Time magazine called her an environmental hero in 2003. A few years later, Forbes called her one of the 7 most powerful women on the globe. Dr. Vandana Shiva, thanks for joining us in the exchange today.
My pleasure. And I look forward to being in Ashland tomorrow.
Great. Was there an event, Dr. Shiva, or a sequence of events that put you on this path in life?
Oh, yes, very clearly. I mean, you know, I had decided I was going to be a physicist, and that's what I studied, and I did a PhD in the foundations of quantum theory. But my ecological activist path was triggered by deforestation in my home region in the Himalaya, and it was a beautiful movement called CHIPCO, which in the U.S. took on the name Tree Huggers, which got me involved. You know, women said, we're going to hug the trees, you'll have to cut us up before you cut a tree. It took 10 years, but we stopped logging in the high mountains in the watershed. And that's what made me realize that each of us, born on this earth, the rent we pay is being active in protecting this beautiful planet of ours. But we can't be a small group of activists. Everyone must be an activist in the face of the threats to the earth. And the next big watershed for me, which threw me into agriculture and the heart of agriculture, was 1984. This is, of course, the title of Orwell's book, 1984. But it was the year in India. There were 2 very, very tragic events, both linked to agriculture. One was a leak from a pesticide plant owned by Union Carbide in the city of Bhopal the night of 2nd December. Carbide is now owned by Dow Chemicals, one of the companies bringing GMOs around the world. But that leak killed 3,000 people immediately and thousands since then. And hundreds of thousands are maimed and crippled, and children are still being born crippled. That same year, the land of Punjab, which is the most fertile land of India, the most prosperous land of India, it's the land of 5 rivers, that's what Punjab means, it exploded in violence, and the Indian military was sent into Punjab, into the sacred temple of the Golden Temple. And then we had an unleashing of further violence, but all told, more than 50,000 people were killed in that violence. And I had a very simple question in my mind. The Green Revolution, which was applied in Punjab to introduce chemicals in agriculture, introduce intensive irrigation that destroyed the water in the land, got farmers into debt. It had been given a Nobel Peace Prize in the 70s, and I wasn't seeing any peace. I was only seeing violence. At that time, I was working with the United Nations University on a major program on peace and global transformation, particularly the peace related to ecology and natural resources. And I said to the United Nations University, something big is going on here, and I'd like to know. And I did, and I wrote The Violence of the Green Revolution as a result of my research. But also, I felt so compelled that I had to dedicate the rest of my life to ecological agriculture. It's not, you know, for me, it's not enough to study issues. If the issues have huge impact on people and the planet, then you've got to do something about it. So that's when I committed myself to start sustainable agriculture practice. And then 87, as a result of that book, I was invited to a biotechnology conference where the big chemical giants were now taking over the seat through genetic engineering and patenting, and they laid out their plan. They said, we've got to have an international trade treaty in which we will have intellectual property. That's what became WTO. And they're taking it even further through the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the Transatlantic Investment and Trade Partnership. They said the only way we can claim a patent on a seed is through genetic engineering, because now we can pretend we've invented the seed. And it was a very small meeting, so we had very honest conversations. It wasn't the kind of vicious attacks they're engaged in today, because the empire is crumbling. But that's the day I decided the rest of my life would be dedicated to not just promoting ecological agriculture, but ecological agriculture based on biodiversity and the freedom of the seed to be a freely evolving seed, as well as the freedom of farmers to save seed, to be GMO-free, and the freedom of eaters to be free of toxic chemicals and to know what they're eating, which is why the DARC Act in this country is so significant, not just for food and food democracy, but democracy across the board.
Okay, it's not officially the DARC Act. I know that is the acronym for it that the activists used, denying anyone the right to deny Americans the right to know. Is where the dark comes from, right?
Yes. So it's denying Americans the right to know. The Orwellian title is Safe Food, Food Safety. And you can just recognize that every time corporations use the word, you can be sure it's the opposite.
Vandana Shiva is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about food safety, sustainable agriculture, you name it. There's a number of areas in which she is an activist. You may join us on the exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone anywhere in the region, 800-838-3760, email address jx@jeffnet.org. I was going to ask if it's fair to characterize you as anti-globalization. You rattled off TPP and the WTO and a couple of other acronyms in there. Is it that you oppose globalization per se, or the way it is done with the existing treaties?
Well, I'm against corporate globalizations where corporations write the rules and they undermine the ecological rules of the planet, because Gaia has her own laws. That's ecological science. That's the laws of nature. And nations have framed their constitutions and their laws. And what we see being done in the name of free trade is corporate rule being established, and I am against corporate rule because it's dishonest, it's destructive. Destructive of the planet, it's destructive of democracy, destructive of human lives. India had total food sovereignty and seed sovereignty. 80% of the seed used to be in farmers' hands before the WTO. WTO allowed corporations like Monsanto to enter India. And in these, since 1995, when the WTO was established, we have seen more than 300,000 farmers commit suicide. India produced her own food as a result of dumping, as a result of destruction of our food security, as a result of diverting our land to cash crops. We have witnessed in these years of corporate-led globalization, where treaties on intellectual property are written by Monsanto, treaties on agriculture are written by Cargill, treaties on services are written by the financial giants. What we have seen is India taken to situations worse than the colonial times, where every fourth Indian is now hungry, every second Indian child is wasted and stunted, and India has emerged as the capital of hunger, beating sub-Saharan Africa. Now, if I'm a scientist, this is the law, this is the consequence, this is the impact, what is the change we need to make? The change we need to make is a planetary globalization, where the planet comes first and we work according to the rules of the planet to lighten our footprints, which is all the issue on climate change, all the issue on dependence on fossil fuels, it's all the issue of species extinction, water destruction, but also the laws of human rights. The two higher laws that must be obeyed at any time are the laws of the planet and the laws of human rights built into our constitution. Any treaty that violates those two sets of laws can only be engaged in crimes against the earth and crimes against the earth. And for me, that is unacceptable.
On issues like genetic engineering or genetic modifications, do you oppose the engineering itself or the patenting or both?
Well, as far as the issue of patenting life is concerned, it's a fraud on the world. You don't invent life. And patents are granted for inventions. And since seed is not an invention, I think this was a huge mistake. It's a mistake that has been perpetrated in the United States through courts. Never were patents on seed and life ever discussed in the U.S. Parliament. In India, we've managed to shape laws that recognize that patents are not invention, biological processes, and are not inventions. Unfortunately, Monsanto is using the U.S. government to pressure in India to remove those scientific basis of recognizing what's an invention. As far as genetic engineering is concerned, I am totally for deeper studies of life at the molecular level and at the genetic level. But with the awareness of the ecological relationships within the organism, which is called gene ecology, and the organism with the rest of the world, which is called epigenetics. Now, both gene ecology and epigenetics are teaching us that the crude idea of life being a machine like a Lego set where you move pieces around and there's no consequence, that that's a false assumption. And any engineering done on that false assumption will bring severe consequences that are not desirable. I will give you a simple example. Right now, as we speak, there is a white fly epidemic knocking out the GMO BT cotton in the state of Punjab, which was destroyed first by the Green Revolution. 15 farm suicides have taken place because of the crop failure, because of the fact that farmers have gotten to death because of pesticides, the illegitimate royalty collection, and have sprayed 12 to 14 times to control the pest, each spray costing 3,200 rupees. Farmers are blocking trains. There is a farmer strike going on right now. We could have predicted this. Why is it scientifically predictable that GMOs designed to control pests will create pests? First, because a monoculture is an invitation to pests. Second, by engineering a plant with a toxic gene that doesn't belong to that plant, that's what BT is, and forcing it to express in every cell of the plant all the time, you basically cripple the plant from acting to defend itself from other pests. Its ability for pest control, which is built into every living plant, is disabled, as a result of which new pests are being created in GMO crops. The pest that was supposed to be controlled has become resistant to the BT, just as the weeds that were supposed to be controlled in the United States by Roundup have become resistant to Roundup and are now super weeds taking over half of the farmland of the country. Now, as a scientist, I assess a tool on the basis of A, is it safe with full knowledge of what you're changing? B, what are its implications for the soil organism, for the pollinator, for the farmer themselves? Is it working? Tools are supposed to work. Now, tools designed for pest control and weed control, if they're creating super pests and super weeds and new pests, they are a failed technology. They have become failed tools. So I really feel it's time to move into the assessment, an honest, independent, democratic assessment of the GMO experiment, because that's what it is. The experiment isn't completed in the lab. The experiment continues in our field. And the experiment is taking the lives of soil organisms and of pollinators, and in my country, it's taking the lives of them.
Dr. Vandana Shiva, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, speaking in Ashland tomorrow night about seed sovereignty, food security, and climate resilience. You can join the discussion on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. We'll be taking the balance of the hour with Dr. Shiva. 800-838-3760, email address jx@jeffnet.org. You are going to be arriving tomorrow in the only county in Oregon that, according to the state legislature, is allowed to have a ban on GMO crops. I wonder if that was part of the appeal of showing up here.
Well, it definitely was. because I think any place on this planet where people are exercising their duty to protect the Earth, the species, and people's lives, and are mobilizing through their democratic rights and democratic energies to create safety in a serious way needs to be honored. And my to Ashland is basically to give support and solidarity and say keep on. And I would like to mention now that on the 1st of January 2015, the California legislature passed a strange law, speed law, saying first that corporations are persons, which again is illusionary, it's illusion. Corporations are legal entities, and we allow their charters on the basis of their responsibility to society. They are not human beings. They are not persons like you and me. That's the first falseness. The second is that new law prevents any county from making any law related to seed, which is designed, in fact, to take away the freedom of counties to make GMO-free regions. And the third is a neighbor will only be counted to be 3 miles. If you go and exchange seed 3.1 miles, it is considered illegal activity. And today, with all the knowledge we have, that industrial breeding gave us toxics, it gave us pesticides, it's given us cancer epidemics, that it's given us uniformity in monocultures, making species disappear. 93% of cultivated varieties have gone. At this point, to say it's the only way to do breeding and only corporations can finance research for the seed is so backward-looking. We today know ecological agriculture is the way to the future. We know evolutionary breeding and participatory breeding is the way to the future. We know biodiversity and not monoculture are the way to climate resilience. So I do hope, just as the people of the county work to declare themselves GMO-free, they will work to tell the governor of California and the agriculture secretary that their duty to the earth, to biodiversity, and their own rights prevent them from following that law, and that law should be retracted.
I wonder how far, and I ask this of a lot of people who oppose genetic engineering, whether that opposition extends to just simple hybridization, making different varieties of existing organisms through breeding, crossbreeding.
No, not at all. Otherwise, you'd have seen the movements that have emerged today at the time when hybrids were introduced. There is, of course, a problem with hybrids that they don't breed through, which means farmers can't save them, and therefore it does increase cost of seed. But hybrids can be broken down into their parent lines, and farmers can start breeding all over again, which is what people are doing all over the world. Neither farmers breeding, which is 99.9% of all breeding through human history, the hybrids and crossbreds, have introduced genes that don't belong to the organism, that therefore destabilize the organism's self-organization, self-regulating capacities, making it more prone, for example, to pests like the white fly in Punjab right now, and add toxic genes that don't belong to either the crop or the food. Every GMO seed, and therefore every GMO crop, and therefore every GMO food, has a toxic gene. In the case of BT, it's the BT toxin. In the case of herbicide resistance, it's toxic genes that help the plants become resistant to the spraying of Roundup. But there's always an antibiotic resistance marker, which means aggravating the crisis of antibiotic resistance through the risks of horizontal gene transfer. And then there are always viral promoters, because the plant has a tendency to silence the introduced gene expression. And we don't want that in our food. Sadly, this combination is rarely tested. In the United States, there's no testing whatsoever. Because after the 1992 Earth Summit, when an article was introduced for biosafety in the Convention on Biological Diversity, President Bush walked out and said, I'm going to protect my biotech industry. And they put out an order on substantial equivalence saying, pretend the GMO is equivalent to a non-GMO. Why is this wrong? First, because when it comes to owning that seed, The same companies go out and said, we've made something new. It's totally different from what farmers have done and what nature gives us. Then it becomes novel. But when it comes to responsibility for assessing safety, it becomes the same as nature. Substantial equivalence is an unscientific assumption, and scientist after scientist is showing it, even with the BT crop of cotton I was talking about. The naturally occurring BT is a protoxin. It's not a ready-made toxin. It's
Bacillus thuringiensis, yes, familiar with it. Mm-hmm.
It goes through the gut of the caterpillar family of insects to become a toxin and then kill that family. But in the plant, it's no more a protoxin because it's a truncated gene, and now it's expressing itself all the time. And the difference must be studied rather than assumed, and you deploy crops that are creating new pests and getting pollen.
So the stuff is out there already is the point, and we're creating we've opened a Pandora's box, I gather, is what you're saying. We'll come back and talk more with Dr. Vandana Shiva. Again, her appearance in Ashland tomorrow night is entitled Seed Sovereignty, Food Security, and Climate Resilience. The actual talk itself is sold out on the Southern Oregon University campus, but nearby in the Rogue River Room at the Stevenson Union, there'll be a closed-circuit television version of it that will be allowing adults in by donation, sliding scale of $3 to $5, children free. Dr. Vandana Shiva will come back and join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back from this break in a minute 15. Eight 36 on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. You can find us online at jeffexchange.org. Check us out on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Jeff Exchange, or take part in our conversations as they happen. Dr. Vandana Shiva, still our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, talking about food sovereignty, food security issues. Her emphases are on sustainability, organic farming, and resistance to corporate agriculture and intellectual property rights on food sources. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Dr. Shiva and Ashland for a speech tomorrow night. Sold out, but a closed-circuit television airing just a few blocks away on the Southern Oregon University campus on the Stevenson Union Rogue River Room. Dr. Shiva, I want to come back to GMO in just a little bit, but I want to get a sense of what agriculture is like in your native India, whether it has become as corporate as it has in America, where you have large farms run by industry to the extent that we do in the United States.
Well, large farms owned by industry is not possible in India because you might remember a big part of our fight against British imperialism was reversing the land concentration laws, the zamindari laws they had created to collect lots of revenue. So by law in India, only small farms are legal, and they're ceilings, as we call it, on land ownership. So India's a land of small farmers. There are very, very different systems of agriculture. The areas where Monsanto has managed to push its GMO cotton, illegally, I must mention, because I had to sue them in the Indian Supreme Court for entering without permission. Those monocultures are on small farms, but they are large areas of many small farms, and that's why we're having the devastation with new pests, and we're having the epidemic of farmer suicides concentrated in the cotton areas. We also have, for example, the attempt to push other cash crops, Pepsi pushing GM, pushing potatoes for its chips, or Monsanto pushing hybrid corn for animal feed, not for human food. Now, in those areas, the farms haven't become large, but that's where farmers are losing. On the other hand, we've got the agroecological initiatives that movements like ours, through Navania, the movement I started for seed saving, is growing and spreading. The farmers save their own seeds, therefore they have their own supply and don't get into debt, and the seeds are adapted to their soil, their climate, and are climate resilient. That's the first benefit. The second is by getting rid of chemicals and practicing organic farming and agroecology, farmers save all the money that's hemorrhaging out of rural areas for lethal toxins. The third is we have created direct relationships between growers of food and eaters of food. And this has totally changed the economics of agriculture. If today agriculture has become a losing proposition, it's because the costs of inputs like seeds and chemicals and in this country machinery are so high. And in a globalized free trade system, no matter what a farmer grows, they get nothing for it because the corporations become the single monopoly buyers. Whereas we all need to eat food, and wherever there's a direct link between producers and what we call co-producers, where there are farmers' markets, where CSAs and the fair trade networks we've built in India, farmers get a full price, and producers partner with people in the city to supply good, safe, healthy, fresh food. You address the problem of disease epidemics, of safety, of destruction of democracy by shaping a food democracy. And we've just completed a study, it's entitled called Wealth Per Acre, where we've calculated the externalities of chemical agriculture, and this is about $1.2 trillion a year in India alone. We've then calculated the cost and benefit of the farmers who have seed sovereignty and practice ecological agriculture and shape fair trade arrangements. Their incomes are 10 times more than farmers being trapped in what the corporations would like to do. And that's the way the whole world needs to be. And I would add an additional benefit, which most of the world has not woken up to. The single biggest contributor to climate change is industrial globalized agriculture. My book, Soil Not Oil, assessed it was about 40%. Scientists are now saying it's even more. On the other hand, with ecological agriculture, with every inch of grassland and farmland converted to organic, we can not just get emissions down to zero, we can draw out the additional carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases that are built up in the atmosphere and are destabilizing the planet. And in 5 years, a commitment to an organic planet, which is the only kind of planet we should have, would actually reversals in the buildup of greenhouse gas.
So you're saying the land would be used for carbon sequestration in that case?
Yes, organic soils, by pulling the carbon out of the air where it doesn't belong in the quantities it's been put in since industrialization, in the soil from where it's been taken out. And that's organic farming. Organic farming is just simply the ecological law of return, giving back organic matter to the soil. And I would differentiate between dead carbon and living carbon. Living carbon means carbon that becomes the food of the microorganisms, which then convert it to soil fertility and convert it into increased food production. So the solutions to hunger, to poverty, to climate change, and the lack of democracy are all the same solution, which is good farming, taking care of the land.
Dr. Vandana Shiva, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, speaking on Ashland tomorrow night about seed sovereignty, food security, and climate resilience. And our guest on the Jefferson Exchange for about another 10 minutes. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Larry in Arcata, California. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Vandana Shiva.
Hi, it's an honor to talk to you. Hello. I had a question. Can...
Yes.
The seeds developed in the Green Revolution be effectively used with organic agricultural techniques?
All right, so interesting. So seeds from the Green Revolution, whether they can be farmed organically. Thanks for the question, Larry. Dr. Shiva?
You see, the seeds of the Green Revolution were bred for responding to chemicals. They are designed for chemicals. They do not perform that well under organic conditions. Therefore, you need organic breeding under organic conditions, not under chemical input.
All right, that would seem a pretty clear answer. I want to expand a little further on the idea of food sovereignty. You've mentioned it in passing a couple of times. How do we assert food sovereignty in any part of the world?
Well, I think for the farmer, food sovereignty is the ability to grow food, the ability to grow food under just and fair conditions so they're not punished for bringing nutrition to society, which is what's happening today. Farmers are being punished for doing the most important work there is on the planet. But food sovereignty is also the right of all citizens to have safe food, to have healthy food, to have nutritious food, to have enough food. After all, this prosperous country, the USA, has food deserts. Isn't that a scandal? That shouldn't be. And it's only because food is so corporatized that it can only reach those who have buying power rather than be grown by those who have growing power, which is all of us. So we should shift to the recognition that everyone can be a grower of food. We need to respect, reward, recognize small farmers, but we need to create urban gardens all over, and we need fair distribution. I've done calculations that in India alone, we are spending about ₹1 trillion and more for food subsidy programs to get bad food to people. The same is happening in this country. Instead of bringing bad, toxic GMO food to the poor, that kind of money could be shifted to help get healthy, organic, safe food to people who can't afford to buy it. So food sovereignty is really an issue of democracy.
Can organic farming deliver the kinds of yields that are necessary to deliver the amount of food necessary for all the people who need it?
This question that you asked is the heart of what has ended up being the big myth that industrial agriculture feeds us. Farms have output. That means they have multifunctional output. You fertilize the soil, you maintain windbreaks, you grow many kinds of crops. You have integration between livestock and trees and crops. Those farming systems with biodiverse output far outdo any industrial monoculture where you only measure the yield of a single thing. Yield applies to individual monoculture crops. Now, yields have not fed the world. 90% of the corn and soya grow in the name of feeding the world goes to biofuel and animal feed. It is not food for human beings. Only 30% of the food people eat on the planet today, and this is data of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, only 30% comes from industrial farms. 70% comes from small farms that are being pushed to a corner and are using only 25% of the land. Industrial agriculture, while feeding us only 30%, has destroyed 75% of the planet's ecological wealth, the soil, the water, the biodiversity, and 40% of the climate damage. You push it to 45%, you're going to have a dead planet. There's no food, no people on a dead planet. And we need to replace the word yield with measuring nutrition. That's why we have, in Afghania, evolved the term of health per acre, measure the nutrition. And we can feed to India's with balanced, adequate nutrition if we increase biodiversity and grow food ecologically on the same amount of land. So it's time to move away from this manipulated measure called yield into measuring the ecological resilience of systems and the total food and nutrition output, as well as the incomes of farmers. A system that in the name of increasing yield pushes farmers into debt and wipes out small farmers and family farms is non-sustainable at the social level. And we need more farmers, not less.
Another call, this one from Charlie and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Vandana Shiva.
Good morning, yes. You mentioned sequestering carbon from the atmosphere into the soil. 1 acre slice of soil contains approximately 2 million pounds. 1% organic matter is 20,000 pounds. How do you propose to do this?
To increase the amount of organic matter in the soil?
Yes. Seeing that in order to increase 1%, to increase organic matter 1%, it takes 20,000 pounds of organic material. And that's long-term sequestration, not just dumping a bunch of straw on the surface.
All right, let's get an answer. Thanks for that, Charlie.
Yeah, two issues related to that. First, we definitely need to grow more organic matter. All of the Green Revolution was based on dwarf varieties that shrunk organic matter. I've just been visiting our farms in central India. A sorghum variety 18 feet tall. With that kind of organic matter, you can have huge abundance, and the 1% target is so easy to reach. Because under industrial agriculture, we have first created monoculture that destroy the capacity to produce organic matter. We've destroyed the pulses, the legumes that fix nitrogen for free. We used to always have mixtures of cereals and pulses. Third, the use of herbicides like Roundup are further taking down the system of organic matter production. I would then add that systems where you have integration of livestock, crops, and trees, which is the only sustainable recycling system for organic matter, have been replaced by single function factory farms, the CAFOs, which turn organic matter into a pollutant that's so difficult to deal with, clear cutting of forests, plantations, and monocultures just corn and the soya. That is what has created an organic matter scarcity. We can reverse that scarcity creating system by looking not at flows of commodities so Cargill can sell and buy more at higher profits, but flows of living organic matter at local ecosystem level and at farm level. We do it. It's totally doable. We've built up 2.2 tons per hectare on our farm. And with that kind of increase, we can have 100% removal of the excess carbon.
The kind of farm you describe sounds like the kind of thing that is being done by Joel Salatin at Polyface Farms in Virginia. We've had him on a couple of times. I wonder if you've ever had a chance to look at his operation.
I haven't ever visited him, but I have been on platforms with him. And I love the title of his book, Everything I Do is Illegal, because this fraudulent industrial system, which is unscientific, undemocratic, failing at every serious measure, ecological level, farmers' level, our health level. After all, food is supposed to be about nourishment. This system is now getting so desperate, it's trying to make everything that would nourish the planet and people illegal, whether it's seed saving and growing biodiversity or food processing and artisanal processing at farm level. So, yes, I know Joel and features to his work of integration.
So, in the minute or so we have left, what's a good first step for anybody who wants to follow your path? I mean, what are the things they could do in their own neighborhoods, wherever they are, to start thinking in terms of food sovereignty?
Well, I think no matter who you are, take one seed that's open pollinated, can multiply, can be saved, and can be shared. And even if there's no land around you, take a little pot in your windowsill and say, dear beloved seed, I will not allow you to disappear or be colonized. I will work for my freedom with your freedom. Second, whoever can start a garden should start a garden. We call this the gardens of hope, of resilience in the face of a shutting down and collapse by the corporate empire. Third, whoever you are, you have to eat. Start remembering that with every morsel that you eat, you're shaping the future of this planet. You can be either part of the destruction by thoughtless, careless eating, which also destroys your health, or thoughtful, careful eating, which nourishes the land, the farmer, and your health.
Dr. Vandana Shiva will speak tomorrow night in Ashland about seed sovereignty, food security, and climate resilience. That talk at 7 o'clock at the Southern Oregon University is sold out, but there is a closed circuit showing of it in the Rogue River Room at the Stevenson Union at Southern Oregon University, same time, just a few doors away. I want to thank Dr. Vandana Shiva for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.
All right, take care.